This is Puget Sound Now, a look inside the issues happening in our communities around the Sound.
Devastating floods in the Southeast, now deadly wildfires in Southern California. Team Rubicon there to help.
A lot of people across the country ready to give their time, their energy, and their experience to help people on their worst day.
A veterans-based humanitarian organization with skills to take on disasters. Quality oral care lacking in many rural parts of Washington State.
Oral health can affect nearly every facet of our lives.
Dental therapists could be part of the solution. Hello again, Bill Swartz, steering the Puget Sound Now ship, and glad to have you along. First up, freezing temperatures have arrived here in western Washington. Thousands sleep on the streets, under bridges, in tents, cars, RVs, and quite often even people and families with housing brave the cold in summer clothes because they can't afford to buy the winter clothing. Well, we have a way for you all to help. Our guest on Puget Sound Now this morning is Grace Sika, Executive Director for the national nonprofit called Operation Warm. Many thanks for the visit and this great conversation.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here speaking with you today.
Well, for 23 years, Operation Warm's mission has been what, Grace?
Our mission is to provide children in under-resourced situations the gift of a brand new winter coat, athletic shoes, and socks, and to do it in a way that connects them to the community resources they need to thrive. In that time, over 20 years, we've helped more than 6 million children across the country, and that is thousands upon thousands in the Puget Sound area as well.
That's fabulous. And these kids go to Title I schools and school districts. They receive federal funding, maybe for lunches, to help them. And the low-income families meet academic standards. Is that how you connect them with these coats?
You've got it right. The way that we connect with children is not by finding individual children, but by connecting to the organizations that see these children every day. And oftentimes that's schools, Title I schools, or schools where just there are any percentage of children in need. But there are other organizations that we partner with as well. Sometimes it is homeless shelters. Sometimes it is Head Starts or child care centers. And the model is that we're able to activate locally by identifying these organizations that see the children every day.
No secret, we're all dealing with high inflation the last 3 to 4 years. Now, low-income families are spending, what, 80% of their income on food, rent, gasoline, electric bills?
It is an astounding statistic. When you think about the difficult choices that families have to make every single day about where to use that last 20%, it's really easy to envision that parents or caretakers are making choices that don't involve new coats and new shoes for children. And so where we step in is we understand that those basic need items can be incredibly valuable for children to show up to school in inclement weather or to get outside and play with their friends during recess. And those are the childhood experiences that we want every kid to have. They're so priceless for our development. And that's where we're committed. We're committed to making sure that children in under-resourced situations have these basic items and are set up to succeed.
We'll tell people in a moment, our listeners, how they can help in this Operation Warm. We're speaking with the Executive Director, Grace Sika. What growth, what need has Operation Warm seen in the number of youngsters throughout the country and families having some form of assistance with clothing or shoes?
The need continues to grow, and I don't think that's surprising to anyone. You mentioned inflation and lots of other social factors that are putting children and their families up against hard decisions. Thankfully, as the need continues to grow, so does Operation Warm's impact. And we're really excited to have partners across the country, across the Puget Sound area, that step up to ensure that the needs are met for their individual communities. And a great example of that is the partnership we're launching with Subaru this week. Mm-hmm. All across the Puget Sound area, Subaru retailers will be working with those beneficiary organizations to identify children in need and then hand delivering coats and shoes to them to make sure that kids have what they need to get through the winter in a really positive and successful way.
Well, because we like to do our homework here on Puget Sound Now, Grace, I have looked up some of our Subaru retailers in Western Washington. Eastside Subaru in Kirkland is a participant. And then in the town of Marysville in Snohomish County, Kendall Subaru is part of this Loves to Help initiative. Last year, they provided 288 coats to the Lutheran Community Services Northwest to distribute. And that's the partnership you're talking about, right?
That's exactly right. And not only are these Subaru retailers delivering the coats and shoes that these children very much need, but they're doing it in a way that adds intangible value. The opportunity for children and their parents and the administrators of these programs to see the support of community volunteers, to see the support of these volunteers from Subaru, really adds to a sense of community connectedness that is priceless and more of what we need.
So lots of organizations ask people to donate new or gently used clothing at a drop-off site. What makes Operation Warm different, Grace?
Well, what makes us unique in this space is we actually don't collect items. Mm-hmm. We manufacture them ourselves. And the reason why we do that is we're committed to a certain standard of quality and diversity in color and style so that the children who receive these items truly receive something that they're excited about. And that idea that for these kids, getting something new that they're really excited about provides a confidence boost, real opportunity for them to feel great when they get into school or get to play with their peers. So when people think about how they can get involved with children who need support in their community, there are some really concrete ways. You can donate dollars. We always appreciate that. You can donate time, and you can learn about all of this on our website, operationwarm.org/Subaru, to see a really concrete example of how this comes to life in local communities.
I'm glad you clarified this. So you're not asking for people to actually bring a coat to a retailer for Subaru.
That's correct. The idea that we manage our own manufacturing and give brand new items is really critical to how we support these children. The children we serve are in serious situations, and the gift of something new adds a gift of confidence and hope that we believe has a real emotional value for these kids.
Warmth equals confidence and hope. You spoke about that briefly, Grace, and we've documented it on Puget Sound Now many times. Clothing can boost a child's self-esteem. Conversely, if a kid shows up in class with raggedy clothes, inadequate shoes, what are some of the negatives?
I certainly know that that old cliche, dress for success, has informed so much about how I present myself every day. And that's true for 5 and 6 year olds as well. When kids show up to school in clothes that are ill-fitting or in bad shape, it's hard for them to participate with their peers and in the classroom in a confident way. So we want to remove that barrier for children, and we want to set them up so that they can feel confident amongst their peers and they can get to school in inclement weather. And that's really the goal that we're after.
And I think there's case studies supporting this concept that show when a child is dressed for success, why they feel so good about themselves when they report to class.
The ability for children to perform better when they feel better emotionally is very well documented. And that's the basis of our program and the basis of our commitment to providing kids brand new items of high quality that not only meets their physical need for warmth or comfort, but also their emotional needs of confidence and hope.
The program is Loves to Help Initiative through Operation Warm, a national nonprofit. Tell us about the duration of your campaign, Grace.
The Subaru Loves to Help program has been supporting Operation Warm for 2 years. And in cumulative, we have helped 290,000 children across the country. The Subaru campaign launches this week and will carry through the end of February. But every year, Operation Warm distributes 1 million coats and shoes to children across the country. We're here and we're in the community annually. You can learn more about what we do at operationwarm.org.
Beautiful. You've outlined the need, and now our listeners know how they can help. Executive Director Grace Sika with Operation Warm, many thanks for being our guest on Puget Sound Now.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Thank you so much. Stay warm.
Some of you might be aware, poor oral health is linked to several diseases, including heart disease, stroke, diabetes, and some cancers. And a lot of people in the Pacific Northwest, unfortunately, don't have access or they can't afford regular dental checkups. And in some cases, people living on tribal reservations in remote parts of Washington State don't have dental care close to them. Maybe a dental therapist is part of the solution. Let's find out. Stopping by Puget Sound Now is Dr. Donald Chi, Associate Dean for Research at the University of Washington School of Dentistry. Thank you so much for your time. And
good to be here, Bill.
As I said at the top of this segment, people sometimes don't realize dental health can lead to other diseases, lack of dental health, should I say.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of growing research, and the research continues on looking at links between poor oral health and other diseases of the body. I think more importantly, or equally as important, is just how the effect that poor oral health can have just on our daily lives. So when you think about having to go to work or having to go to school, if you have a toothache, both of those things are going to be really tough. If you have a toothache, it's going to be hard to get to sleep. It's going to be hard to get rest. And I'm a parent of two young kids. I'm already tired without toothaches in my life. I mean, you know, toothaches can really cause a lot of problems. And so really, I think when I think about poor oral health, really, it's, you know, poor oral health can affect nearly every facet of our lives.
What led you to look at the role of dental therapists as it pertains to the overall access to oral health?
Yeah, so, you know, I was trained as a health services researcher, which is a branch of public health aimed at looking at how dental care is delivered and how it's financed. And so, you know, typically, you know, the dental care delivery system in the U.S., you know, it's pretty simple. You know, you have dentists, you know, you go to the dentist provides dental care. And that's it. And in the early 2000s, Alaska actually started experimenting with dental therapists. And I say experiment, so this is relatively new in the U.S. However, dental therapy has been around for nearly 100 years globally. So the U.S. was a little late to the game, but Alaska was able to pass legislation that allowed dental therapists to practice in tribal communities. And when the opportunity came up, we continued to face access to care problems in the U.S., millions of people not being able to get to the dentist, millions of people being blocked out of the dental care delivery system. I just got interested and I wanted to see, hey, you know, what effect has dental therapists had in Alaska? And I had just a wonderful opportunity to look at data to answer that question.
Our guest on Puget Sound Now is Dr. Donald Chi, Associate Dean for Research at the University of Washington School of Dentistry. I think we should back up a step and say, what is a dental therapist? What's the training required? What is the skill set?
You know, each state determines whether or not dental therapists are allowed to practice in their state. So practice laws are passed at the state level. So each state is going to have something a little different. And so, for instance, in Alaska, dental therapists are recruited out of high school. They get about 2 to 3 years of training. And then at that point, they work in clinics under the general supervision of a dentist. So dental therapists are not practicing by themselves. They are working with a team of dental professionals to provide dental care. And in terms of the dental treatments that they're able to provide, again, under the supervision of a dentist, it ranges from preventive care, so cleanings and fluoride treatment, all the way to simple fillings and tooth extractions. And it's the type of care that they're trained to provide. Now, the more complicated dental treatments, so complex fillings, really difficult tooth extractions, implants, dentures, you know, those types of things are still reserved for dentists.
When I go twice yearly to my own dentist, it's usually a hygienist who does the cleaning, the x-rays. What's the difference between a dental hygienist and a therapist?
Yeah, that's, again, it'll depend on the state. And in Washington, we have pretty liberal dental hygienist practice laws. So dental hygienists are actually able to do quite a bit in Washington. Now, dental therapists actually would be part of providing diagnostic care. So a dental therapist could again work with a dentist to diagnose dental disease and actually remove cavities. So that would be one example. So hygienists in Washington currently are not able to remove tooth decay from a tooth, but they're able to fill a tooth. So yeah, all these little nuances and intricacies in terms of scope of practice, and it can get really complicated in terms of determining who can do what.
It sounds like it. Washington State did update its laws in 2023, permitting dental therapists to practice on tribal lands with tribal patients. Is there a way to extend that service to non-tribal members? Let's say migrant workers who are very prevalent in central and eastern Washington and don't have access to good oral care.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think dental therapists, really the idea of dental therapists, you know, really is applicable to all populations that are blocked out of the dental care system. So when we think about individuals living in rural areas, people who don't have insurance, you know, people who live in areas just where there aren't dentists, those are all kind of areas that I think would be perfectly acceptable areas to consider dental therapists. And I think the point with all of this really is that, you know, we need to go to the communities where the need is. And so whether that's tribal lands or rural areas, or even urban areas where there are no dentists or dentists, you know, who are able to treat indigent populations. Those are the places where we need dental therapists.
Dr. Chi, are many of those tribal and underserved populations lacking essentials like toothbrushes or maybe education to avoid cavity-causing foods and drinks?
How we keep people out of the dental office, and those are really behaviors, you know, things like healthy eating, things like, you know, access to fluoride. So whether that be fluoridated water or fluoridated toothpaste. And so that's my other really big line of research that I do here at UW is trying to find ways to help individuals make healthier dietary decisions. So how is it that we can help families give their kids less sugary beverages, for instance? And then how we can enforce things like community water fluoridation, as well as regular toothbrushing at home with fluoridated toothpaste. And what ends up happening is that if the sugar is if there's a lot of sugar in the diet, you're not getting enough fluoride, you know, you may go see a dental therapist or a dentist, but every 6 months there's going to be disease, and so that's going to back up, you know, that's going to block up the system. And so there's only so much treatment the dental system can provide.
Because you are so connected with the University of Washington and a renowned dental school, are you seeing a lot more people interested in the profession and maybe accessing it through this dental therapy route?
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, dental school is a long haul process. You know, you go to school for 4 years after high school. So, you know, 4 years of college, 4 years of dental school here in Washington. And then if you want to specialize, you know, you may end up going to school for another 2 to 6 years after dental school. So it can be a really long process. And so when you think about the type of student or individual who might end up in dental school versus dental therapy, you know, dental therapy is a much quicker route to get to the point where you can provide dental care.
Is it fair to say once they have some of that training and see how it all works, they might want to become doctors of dentistry as well?
Sure, absolutely. I think that's always an option. One of the great things about Alaska is that the dental therapy program actually will recruit from local communities. And then those individuals will actually return to their communities. And so they're able to speak the local language. They have a shared history. If that person was then interested in going into dentistry and then doing the same thing, going back and being able to provide that higher level of dental treatment for their communities, I think that's wonderful.
That's a win-win. Anything else we can add about Washington State in specifics as it relates to dental therapists? Is there maybe a population or an area where you'd like to see this program expand?
You know, I think right now, you know, dental therapy is limited to tribal communities in Washington, but we have a lot of other types of communities that are in high need. So when I think about community health centers, rural areas in Washington, not so different from Alaska when we think about areas where there just aren't enough dentists to provide the treatment that's needed. So we'll all be looking at future legislation to see how the practice of dental therapy changes in Washington.
Dr. Donald Chi, from the Associate Dean for Research at the University of Washington School of Dentistry, our guest on Puget Sound Now. All the best to you.
Thanks so much, Bill.
Well, in 2024, it was hurricanes and flooding in the southeast United States, and now to start a new year, Southern California wildfires have claimed lives, destroyed thousands of homes, schools, churches, and businesses. And the common thread in these disasters, Americans help other Americans. One organization dedicated to service is Team Rubicon, a veteran-led humanitarian organization. And right now, they have gray shirts on the ground in Southern California. We are pleased to share their story. Team Rubicon CEO Art De La Cruz, our guest on Puget Sound Now. Thank you, and how are you?
I'm doing fine, and thanks for having me, Bill.
Your national headquarters are in Southern California. How has this impacted the people in your own organization?
Yeah, you know, it has impacted our organization. We were founded in Los Angeles 15 years ago, and this disaster has touched our employees and the organization. In some affected having to evacuate, some with family members that have lost homes, and all of us feeling that this mission is as close to our hearts as anything we've experienced.
You started 15 years ago. That's the history. What is the mission of Team Rubicon worldwide?
Well, we are a veteran-led humanitarian organization that helps communities before, during, and after disasters and crises. We've done over 1,200 operations, you know, since our founding. And that initial founding some 15 years ago was 8 people. And now I'm proud to say we have 180,000, to include 12,000 in Los Angeles and San Diego. So a lot of people across the country ready to give their time, their energy, and their experience to help people on their worst day.
From JBLM to Whidbey Naval Air Station, we have a lot of vets in the Puget Sound, Western Washington region. We've talked with a lot of them on this show, and their organization, their experience, their expertise makes them so perfect for these kind of disasters to help, right?
Yeah, you can, you know, if you're at Whidbey Island and you watch one of those growlers take off, it's really easy to simplify and say that's just a pilot or that's just a, you know, an aviation, you know, ordnanceman. But what you really have to do, and to include everyone who's taken off that uniform, is understand they've been through a really unique school. They went through the School of the Navy, and from the day they started boot camp, they began to understand the importance and learn how to lead. They understand the importance of teamwork. They understood decision making. All of those things are incredibly important in disasters when chaos is introduced. You know, they oftentimes look for, you know, women and men that can make decisions. And those are the things that really amplify, you know, the service in uniform. And most importantly, the service after you take that uniform off.
Art, did you serve?
I did. I spent 22 years in the Navy, and I was a little bit south of you from Whidbey there. I flew out of Lemoore, California and Oceana, but I have a lot of friends in that area who continue to, you know, serve and be a part of that amazing community.
Well, let me first of all say thank you for that service. Now, your leadership, how is that important in getting all of the gray shirts organized for the LA fires?
Yeah, I'd like to say that, you know, if we are successful with our volunteers getting to points of need, then the organization and the communities are going to be successful and recover faster. So we've made significant investments in technology where we've, you know, essentially prepared, you know, our standing force well before this disaster. We have 12,000 volunteers that, you know, we've organized and recruited in our 15 years of existence. We've trained a bunch of them. We responded out to disaster after disaster after disaster. And now we can apply all of that in this moment, this unpredictable fire, to help people on their worst day. And it's best practices that allow us to make things that used to be difficult routine. And it's also bringing these skills and being able to accommodate, you know, requests that we didn't expect because we're agile and nimble. And because, again, we bring those skills and training.
Art De La Cruz, our guest on Puget Sound Now. He is the CEO of Team Rubicon, a humanitarian organization led by veterans, acting globally and now locally, certainly Los Angeles. How bad is it?
You know, it's like nothing I've ever seen. It's essentially, and a former FEMA administrator said, this is Los Angeles's Katrina. You know, and you think of that terrible hurricane in, you know, 2005 that flooded 80% of New Orleans. You know, this is something that's going to exceed that in recovery costs. So it is an immense problem. And it's not just the problem that we're facing now. It's the difficulties and the second disaster that, you know, these are going to form. We're actively talking to emergency managers now, understanding that these burn-scarred areas and the Palisades Hills are ripe for mudslides. So we're already talking about where we're going to, you know, help and pitch in, hopefully, with sandbagging and these mitigation efforts to preserve the homes that survived the fires and also to ensure, you know, that, again, the recovery can continue.
Whether it's Pacific Palisades or Altadena, what are your gray shirts doing physically with earth movers and other construction materials to remove rubble and debris just to get to people's properties?
Yeah, you know, you kind of hit on one of the really important things in disasters and recovery, and that's knowing what to say no to. And, you know, fire is a really, really unique thing where, you know, after a tornado, we'd have CTLs and chainsaws fired up. You know, when you are in a disaster zone impacted by a fire, you know, you think of your garage and all of the things that you wouldn't want to burn, you know, because you're storing them outside of your house. Batteries, there is lead, you know, there's mercury, there's asbestos. So it's a very, very deliberate process to ensure our volunteers and, you know, to the best of our ability, also those people returning to their communities are safe. That's why one of the roles we're playing right now is contributing to access points. So we're side by side with the California National Guard, with police officers and sheriffs to advise people and provide information, you know, while they're controlling, you know, and you know, making sure that people are escorted in the proper way. We're saying, listen, these are the dangers that are in the ashes. These are the different agencies that you can talk to if you need resources. All of that information, again, it's about safety and it's also about recovery.
Yeah, the air is toxic down there, no question. How many personnel do you have involved in this?
You know, it's been really, really interesting. I think it's, you know, we are metering the people that are in the field. But to give you a very specific example of, you know, how amazing the volunteers are, we had a request a couple of days ago that needed 10 people to go to Ventura to help with, you know, home ignition zones. We had 204 people sign up in 15 minutes. You know, wow. We have a logistics hub in San Pedro that we're going to help with. And we submitted, you know, requests for availability, and we have the first three weeks of this thing running booked already with people who've raised their hand and said, you know, I can give you my time and my energy because I believe I can contribute to the mission and make a difference.
That's fabulous. How can people contribute to your cause, to Team Rubicon, and how do you leverage the dollars into this kind of physical support in Los Angeles area?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'd encourage everyone to go to trusa.org. You know, we are actually, you know, cash is king. You know, one of the hidden disasters in a disaster is, you know, the sea of goodwill. You know, it's flooded a lot of our collection points with so many materials that have come out of closets. Now someone has to sort through them. Someone has to figure out where they're supposed to go. They're trying to match them up with need. You know, cash is significantly different because it gives those survivors the ability to dictate what they need, you know, from sizes to medicines, et cetera. So that's a really important piece of, you know, how they can help and contribute. And, you know, again, we could always use more volunteers. We've got a ton of them up there in your neck of the woods, you know, 180,000 across the country. And I'd love to see that number continue to climb. And what I can tell those volunteers is, you know, we'll give you the equipment, we'll give you the process. And if you give us the time and energy, you will turn around at the end of a hard day's work and say, I made a difference.
Team Rubicon, website one more time.
TRUSA.org.
Thank you so much. Art De La Cruz is the CEO of Team Rubicon. Thanks for all the work that your people are doing on behalf of our country and so many folks in need right now.
Thanks, Bill.
Hey, another terrific and meaningful Puget Sound Now show in the books. Want to share or listen again? We're on the podcast page of nwnewsradio.com. And I'm Bill Swartz. We're back again next Sunday morning.
Thank you for listening to Puget Sound Now. Tune in every Sunday morning to learn about the issues happening in our communities around the Sound. Puget Sound Now is a public service of Lotus Seattle Corp.